Welcome, everyone, to the 2016-2017 Football Scholars Forum season. This is kickoff night here, and we're using a new tool, and I'm glad that it's worked well so far. We're no longer using Skype. We're relying on Zoom, which allows us to do a whole bunch of different things, including using cell phones rather than computers to join the conversation. And it's my great pleasure to introduce James Dorsey, the author of The Turbulent World of Middle East Soccer. James is an old FSF hand, shall we say, and he is the senior fellow at the Rajaratnam School of International Studies, Nanyang Technological University, also co-director of the Institute of Fan Culture at the University of Würzburg, and a former journalist, among other things, with newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, also bureau chief for United Press International, Middle East correspondent for Christian Science Monitor, and so on and so forth. It's a great pleasure to have you here, where many of us are assiduous readers of your blog by the same title as the book. And without further ado, we'll turn it over to James. And then if we could use the chat function, everyone, as a virtual queue, we'll have a set of questions. Perhaps we'll start with three or four for the first round and give James an opportunity to respond. Okay?
Sounds good.
So we pass it over to you, James.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for setting this up and for the very gracious introduction. Let me just divide my remarks into two parts. One, the genesis of this whole thing, and two, what I think are, to me at least, the two major takeaways from what I've been doing the last few years. Basically, the story I really would like to tell is that everything I write about is stuff that I saw 30 years ago when I reluctantly accompanied the Mexican national football team to the Middle East on its first ever tour of the region in advance of the Mexican 1986 World Cup. And in fact, everything I saw what I write about today, I saw then: the political abuse of the game, the enormous political role it played in, for various autocratic regimes in the region, the violent tensions that you've seen in various parts of the Middle East, particularly in Egypt, which certainly until 2011 was one of the world's most violent derbies. The tensions that lead to empty stadia in the Gulf, and so on and so forth. The problem with this all is that I saw it and had no idea what I was seeing and didn't connect the dots. And I only really did that 25 years later when I, as a fluke really, on the eve of the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, wrote a piece on essentially trying to explain the political reasons why Middle Eastern and North African teams, by and large, are not frequently and in large numbers represented in World Cup finals. A friend of mine, a very well-known writer at the time, happened to read the piece and phoned me and said, "You have a book." And sort of the penny dropped, someone had to say it to me. And it really fit what I was looking for, which was a way of looking at the Middle East and North Africa through a different prism, one that was not going to be the umpteenth analyst whom you differentiate by looking at how he or she crosses the T's or dots the I's. The other thing I just want to mention is that there's a good reason why I didn't recognize what I was seeing 30 years ago, and that is I'm not a football fan. In fact, I'm not a sports fan. In many ways, this is, a bit of an opportunistic approach. But I do think it's significant, and that leads me to the two takeaways. The two things I think I really learned over the last few years. One is there's always an intersection of sports and politics. In most parts of the world, it is in specific periods of time. It comes and goes. It is not permanent. It is not consistent. It is not always. And that's what it is in the Middle East. and it's been that for a good century. And what I mean with that is football has played a key role in nation formation, nation building, regime formation, regime survival, as well as multiple battles, whether these are social, whether they're economic, whether they're national, whether they're ethnic, whether they're religious, whether they're political. And that, I think, sets the Middle East and North Africa apart from other regions. The second thing that I learned is, and that's related to that, and that is that, and again, that's true for beyond the region, namely that politics and sports are like Siamese twins. They're inextricably intertwined, and they cannot be separated, which leads you, but that we can talk about during the session, with the question from, if you can't separate it, how do you regulate it? Nowhere is that as intertwined as it is in the Middle East and North Africa, and has that shaped not only events in the region, but I would argue to some degree shapes or in any case strongly influences and impacts the way international sports governance, particularly football governance, but not only football governance. If you look at the conflict that Kuwait might have now having initially with the International Olympic Committee, but in fact with all sports associations which have suspended it, or at issues over the leadership of the International Shooting Federation, or the International Volleyball Federation attitude towards countries who do not allow women unfettered access to stadiums. Mm-hmm. Let me leave it at that, and we can pick up a lot within the question and answer. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for that, James. I greatly enjoyed reading the book. Some chapters I was able to find time to read more closely and others not as much. But one of the ones that I enjoyed was the depth into which you get into events in Egypt. I watched the Netflix documentary, The Square, and I was struck by how little that documentary identifies people who are on screen and obviously part of Ultras groups, but are not kind of treating them as their own set of protagonists. Whereas your book, you know, is a great corrective for that. But I wanted to ask a question about sources. I was struck by how many of your footnotes are YouTube links, blogs, forums, or Facebook pages. And I wondered about how, in writing this book and in doing the research, you had any conversations with people you might have been collaborating with, or how this compares to previous scholarly efforts you've undergone in occupying that space as an ethnographic space, right? Like, can you tell us about how closely you were watching these Facebook groups and how closely you had kind of feelers out in social media, or are these things that you were kind of able to retrace through other reporting on it that you then said, I should go and check this page out, or this person keeps on bringing up this particular Facebook group, I should go look at it. Can you tell us about working with these kinds of sources and what you think it brought to your work?
Sure. Let me just, before I do that, just respond briefly to your comment on the Egypt chapter in general. I think if you look at analysis, historical writing, whatever it may be, of Egypt over the last century, what you'll find is that football very rarely figures. The fact of the matter is, this goes back as far back as, for example, 1919, when the Egyptian Revolution. The Egyptian Revolution was planned on the grounds of the Al Ahly Football Club. In fact, that's part of why Al Ahly was founded. And the students who get credited for the 1919 revolution, which then led to independence in 1922, were actually football fans. They were both students and football fans. something that you see repeated in the 70s and you see repeated again in the first 18 to 24 months after the military coup in 2013 in Egypt. Now, as far as the sourcing is concerned, I am in continuous and frequent contact with the office themselves. And through some of these events, I've sat and been there with them. The problem with the reason I've used a lot of YouTube and others, because that's people things people can refer back to. And but you're also talking about people's lives. To give you an example, the backbone of the student protests in Egypt against the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi were ultras, a mixture of ultras from both Al-Ahli as well as the Malik. One of their leaders is a 22-year-old kid who's steeped in the history of Egyptian football. He's a member of the Brotherhood, steeped in the history of the Brotherhood, and is a man who moves around in Cairo with a phalanx, discreetly, but nonetheless a phalanx of bodyguards, because he's been sentenced twice, once in absentia to death, and once in absentia to life in prison. And there are more people like that, and communication is possible, but it's difficult, and you don't want to put those kind of people at any kind of risk.
Maybe I'll jump in here, kind of riffing off of this question by Alex. I really enjoyed the book, James, and I learned so much from it. And it also led me back to the library, as any very good book should. And I read Juan Cole's The New Arabs, because it struck me how much of these conversations that you were having with the young revolutionaries in Egypt and others, you know, had to do really with young people. And Cole says that, what, about a third of the 400 million or so Arabs are part of Generation Y. And he notes in that book how they're quite distinctive as a generation compared to that of their parents, because they're more urban, far more literate, of course, wired, as you just mentioned, and secular. But they also struggle with a lot of problems like high unemployment and so on. And so I thought maybe it would be nice to hear more about your thoughts on this particular generation and how it shapes the relationship between soccer and politics in the Middle East, particularly in relationship to how the game has changed because of technology and communication technology in particular in the 1990s and 2000s. You know, you're talking about satellite TV, deregulation, privatization, you know, the EPL and the internet, smartphones, and so on. So can you tell us a little bit more about these young people in their power and their diversity?
Sure. I mean, I think, first of all, sure, technology plays a big role. If you go back to 2011, people sort of described the Egyptian revolt as the Facebook revolt. I tend to disagree with that, frankly. Having said that, internet did play a big role. I think what one has to understand is two things. One is the ultras, the history of the ultras in the Middle East and North Africa is very recent. We're talking about the first decade of the 21st century. And they really initially started in Morocco and a bit in Tunisia. Where the Egyptian ultras got it from was really surfing the internet, which they were doing in 2004, 2005. And these were middle-class, educated, often employed young people. One of them, in fact, was a UN fellow who surfed the internet, and they came across the ultras in, particularly in Serbia and Italy, to a lesser degree in Argentina. And they found a lot in common there and a lot that sort of filled in where they were, but they may not have quite articulated in that form. they're, because of what ultras represent, their particular analysis of the power structure of the game, their artistic and other forms of expression of support for the club, meant that they, by definition, came into conflict with the regime, which, in terms of ownership of a public space, in this case, the stadium, in a country or in which the regime tolerates no uncontrolled public space. So they actually constituted the only physical confrontation with the regime, if you exclude a bunch of Bedouins in a sandbox out in the Sinai in Egypt. Now, what that did was, and again, the confrontation with the regime was a confrontation with the police force and the security forces, who were the most despised face of the regime, and who were basically the institution that made everybody's life difficult, not only in the stadium, but also in the popular neighborhoods of Egyptian cities. So for a whole a large number of what are called the Wilad Sis, the boys without. In other words, these were boys who were undereducated or uneducated. They were underemployed or unemployed. And this was their release valve. This was their opportunity to confront the one force that they hated. And what that meant is that the ranks of the ultra swelled with thousands and thousands of young men. I would estimate that, I mean, I would at the time put the ultras collectively, the ultras groups, as the second or third largest social movement in Egypt. That is to say, if you at the time would view the Brotherhood as the largest, and then depending how you rank the labor movement, that's, they were up there. You know, this is a generation that indeed has greater access, but also has far and far fewer prospects, and is frustrated. You now have a generation of, say, those that led and participated in the 2011 revolt, who are apathetic, downtrodden, disappointed. And you have a generation that's come up after them that are either far more politically motivated, those that came out of the Islamist movement, or far more nihilistic.
We have a question from Chris Brown next.
Thanks, Alex. Hello, everyone. Hi, James. I have a so I'm interested always in the question of where to begin the story. And in the case of histories of soccer, we're generally familiar with certain aspects of the tale, the early 20th century formation of clubs, etc. And one of the threads that runs through your book is the relationship between interpretations of Islam and the role of soccer in society. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about how references to the pre-modern history of soccer and sports in the Islamic world continue to play a role in those debates about what the role of soccer can be in the various Islamic societies. And you know, how much is there a prominent discussion of the pre-history, so the pre-British, pre-European colonialism, physical cultures, sporting cultures in the Islamic world and their connection to current soccer. And one example which was really interesting that you lifted up, the 2003 fatwa, which demanded that certain aspects of modern soccer be revoked, so the removal of referees, lines, etc. And instead of simply banning it, suggesting that to be more Islamic, it could be played in a different way. So, two things really. I'm interested in the the prehistory and, you know, where to start with the story of soccer in the Middle East and this recurring theme of Islam's and soccer?
I think my basic notion is, if you ask me, is the prehistoric pre-football history of Islamic sports relevant? I think the answer is fundamentally no. What I think that you're seeing is, and there's one exception to that, but even that applies to the fact that I believe that Islam, in this case, is a tool. It's not a driving factor. What I mean with that is this. By and large, for example, you had the emergence of Islamic Muslim sports clubs, football clubs and others, in Algeria in the 1920s. Now, the reason that they were Muslim or Islamic in nature was not because all of their, that's not to say, it was not because all of their members were observant, faithful believers, which they may very well have been. But the motivation to give these clubs a Muslim identity was primarily that was the only identity they could give those clubs within the context of French colonial rule. It was not that they per se wanted these clubs to be Muslim or Islamic. Most clubs throughout the Middle East and North Africa do not identify themselves as Muslim clubs. They identify themselves as any other club does. And the now, let me just take one step back and know that if you look at the major clubs across the region, and that's not just the Arab world, but includes Iran, it includes Israel, and it includes Turkey, all of these clubs were founded with some degree of political association or ideological association. They were pro-colonial regime, anti-colonial regime, pro-monarchy, anti-monarchy. They were expressions of ethnic identity in a few cases, but that was mostly in the case of minorities, maybe a religious identity. Think of Copts in Egypt, for example. Or they were associated with various ideological tendencies, for example, within the Zionist movement. I think what you see throughout the period, the history that I'm covering, is that Islam figures, but it figures because it serves a political purpose. That's true with regard to the relationship between more militant Islamist groups or jihadist groups and football, whereby, you know, the fatwa that you were mentioning was by a group of very militant Saudi scholars who were deeply opposed to the Saudi ruling family. Now, the one place where you're seeing a reference to Quranic sports is in Saudi Arabia's attitude towards the women's participation in international tournaments or women's sports in general. So up until 2012, a Saudi woman representing Saudi Arabia, there was one case of an equestrian prior to 2012, but she did that on her personal steam, personal note, and not as a Saudi representative. But up until 2012, you had no Saudi women representatives. The International Olympic Committee in 2012 put its foot down and basically threatened Saudi Arabia, as well as Qatar and Brunei, which were the other two countries that had never had been represented by women in an international tournament, and certainly not in an Olympics tournament, threatened them with a boycott if they would not put women forward. Saudi Arabia did that. It appointed two women who were expatriates. In the subsequent negotiations or talks with the International Olympic Committee, the Saudi Olympic Committee took the stand that it would only allow women to compete in sports that had been mentioned in one form or the other in the Quran. Now, I don't believe that that was because of deep-seated religious faith as much as it was trying to balance the relationship between the ruling family and the Muslim scholars with whom they have a power-sharing agreement. At a time, and that has become increasingly clear, at a time that that relationship and that power-sharing agreement is inevitably moving towards a restructuring with all the problems that that may or may not entail in the kingdom.
Great. Thanks for your question, Chris. We have three questions lined up now. Let's start with Aubrey.
Thanks, Alex and Peter, for organizing this, and thanks very much, James. Hi to everyone else. James, I was wondering if I could get your thoughts on the recent demonstrations by Celtic fans in solidarity with the Palestinians and whether their open defiance of the threat of sanction from UEFA is sort of perhaps the start of something larger in this sphere amongst football fans in Europe.
Right. Look, I think that you have it links into a much larger picture, which is that there has been football opposition to Israeli policies for now at least 4 or 5 years. You've had in the last 4 or 5 years a number of cases where football players, Palestinian football players, that is to say, Palestinian football players from either the West Bank or Gaza rather than from Israel proper, were arrested on political grounds by the Israeli authorities and often put into what is called administrative detention, which is a leftover of the British colonial rule. In one case, I think it was Sarsak, Mohammed Sarsak, who went on hunger strike and was for a very extended period on hunger strike, and it became perilous. You had prominent European soccer players signing a petition. You've had also, I think it was 60 players signing a petition when Israel was hosting an UEFA under 20 cup, I think it was. A youth cup, and there was great opposition to within European football circles. In a number of cases, FIFA and UEFA have had to intervene to force Israel's hand on issues related to what the Palestinians would describe as obstruction of Palestinian soccer. So the Celtic fan demonstration, again, the Celtic fans are maybe in some ways a unique group because of their own Scottish history. The Celtic fans fit very much into that. What I do think is that the whole thing fits into a much larger picture, which is that what Israel is finding itself, a situation Israel is finding itself in, is that its relationship with the United States, particularly with President Obama, is rocky. Netanyahu at this point is just trying to sit it out and wait who comes in the next election. The Israelis have written Europe off because the mood in Europe has turned anti-Israeli. Israel finds it almost impossible to defend its policies in Israel. And as a result, Israel, like many other countries, is looking east. The Chinese don't give them that kind of headache. Neither do the Indians or others. So I think it's relevant and it's significant, but what it represents is a much larger trend, or it is an expression of that.
Great. We have a question next from Shireen.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Hi, Professor Dorsey. Quick question. You talked about governance in relation to women's involvement in football and sport in the region. And I'm just wondering, I mean, given that the FIFA ban has, you know, was only fully lifted in 2014, do you feel, and this doesn't specifically only apply to players, when we talk about participation, you also mentioned access to stadium, like as they're, you know, relevant to stadium bans in Iran. Do you think that FIFA would really have, has enough as it is, given all the changes, an actual relationship enough with some of the standing governments to be able to make change and afford change in those areas to allow for more participation of women in sport? Is that something that you consider that, and is that the best way to reach out to national federations?
Well, let me, I think there are two different aspects here. FIFA and other international sports associations certainly have enough of a relationship. In fact, I would go much further, and I would describe FIFA throughout the last, half a century as a pillar of Arab autocracy. They've gone out of their way to support it. So, in other words, do they have the leverage? Yes, they do. Are they going to use it? No, they're not. I made some remarks last week in Oxford at a sports conference, in which this was what I was speaking about, and I'll publish those remarks in the next day or two. The point I was trying to make is that you have a situation which I just described with regard to Saudi Arabia. You also have a situation in Iran. Now, let me be clear. Iran, women's sports are far more developed than they are in Saudi Arabia. The issue with Iran is the issue of women's access to stadia where men's sports are being played out. That exists in Saudi Arabia too. In Saudi Arabia, simply the problem goes much further. There's no physical education for girls in schools. There's no infrastructure. The kingdom in the last couple of years developed its first ever 5-year national plan for men only. Now, in the case of Iran, the leader in all of this was not FIFA. It was the International Football Federation, International Volleyball Federation, which, if I'm not incorrect, in 2014, basically told the Iranians, if you do not allow women access to stadia, we will boycott you and you will not be granted, hosting rights. And the Iranians made promises which they didn't keep. The same happened, by the way, with the Asian Football Confederation, for Asian, cup matches and Asian matches that were being hosted in Iran. In the case of the International Volleyball Federation, the Volleyball Federation backed down, declared that it would not boycott Iran on the grounds that it felt that engagement was probably going to achieve much more because this whole attitude towards women was so deeply culturally rooted. Fact of the matter is that the ban on women having access to stadia in Iran, or volleyball, in the case of volleyball, not in the case of soccer, is 5 years old at best. Prior to that, women were allowed to watch men's volleyball games. So there's not much cultural deep roots in this ban. In the case of the AFC went much further. You had in January of last year, you had the Asian Games in Australia, where you have a large Australian-Iranian community. And so you had large numbers of women of Iranian descent, Iranian origin, in the stadium, all decked out in Iranian colors and Western dress and makeup and what have you, cheering on the Iranian team. And so the Iranian Football Federation actually came out and warned its players not to socialize with these women, in response to which the then Secretary General, who later was fired because of my blog, declared that Iran had the right to do whatever it wanted within its own national borders. In other words, it defended the policy of segregation, if you wish. And the point I was trying to make in my remarks last week in Oxford was that I think a boycott of Iran and Saudi Arabia makes sense, but for very different reasons. I actually think in the case of Saudi Arabia, a boycott has the chance of changing Saudi policy. I think in Iran, because of domestic political reasons, there's no chance of changing that policy anytime soon. And therefore, there is nothing to lose for an international federation to adhere to its own principles and values.
Great. Do we have a question from anyone else on maybe a chance for the phone participants who don't have access to the chat function? I know we have Ildefonso and David on the phone who can unmute themselves if they have questions. We'll give them a moment to weigh in if they...
This is Ildefonso. I don't know if David has a question, so I'll pause.
Go ahead, Ile.
I was, first of all, thank you so much for doing this, Alex and James, for coming and talking to us about your book. I was fascinated a little bit about the cyber ethnography that you included in the book as a way to... give the opportunity to have voices that otherwise would be much difficult to obtain. So I was wondering if you would like to speak a little bit about that, and also thinking about the legitimacy that we are creating by having this outlet incorporating our research. I know in my case, women don't have much access to media or corporate media per se, so social media is the voice. If you want to know anything about women's soccer in Argentina, you need to turn to web blogs, you need to turn to Twitter, you need to turn to YouTube videos posted by users, because otherwise you will not be able to see what's going on in this core. I was wondering how is that experience in terms of your own research in this in this sort of like cyber ethnography that you compiling your book through the page.
First, I think there's several aspects here. First of all, cyber often is the primary channel of expression for people in the Middle East and North Africa. Saudi Arabia has one of the highest number of Twitter participants, for example. You find on Saudi Twitter accounts, that ranges from very conservative Muslim scholars to activists, people with followings of 12 million. You know, they compete with Hollywood stars because that is the one area where people can communicate. So in that sense, I think cyber is extremely important. Second of all, certainly in the case of the ultras, and many of you know this, there's a very artistic quality to the ultras. So it's off. It's very visual. It's very musical. It's very graphic, and they tend to put all of that on their Facebook pages, on their Instagram pages, and so on and so forth. So you need to follow that. You need to see that because you're not there. I mean, I'm very frequently in the region, but I'm not there continuously on a day-to-day basis. Having said that, as much as I follow it, I don't. It's not my primary resource. I think I'm, you know, I liberally plagiarized a colleague, a former BBC foreign correspondent who became a professor of communications at the at City University in London, who several years ago in a bio in a book described himself as an academic. And I liberally plagiarized that term because that's exactly what I do. You know, for me, it's still about talking to people. And the literature, the virtual ethnography, all of that is important, but it's secondary, even if it features strongly in my references. It really is about witnessing yourself and talking to people.
Thanks, Ildefonso. Just a second to see if David has anything to weigh in on, but we do have a question if he doesn't. Okay, how about a question from Andrew Guest?
Yeah, thanks. I always enjoy learning about the turbulent world of Middle Eastern football from your writing. I don't know much about it myself, but I actually just wanted to quickly circle back on your comment that you have never been a soccer fan and are still not a soccer fan. And I suspect that's kind of rare amongst those of us in the forum and those of us who are and people that write these kinds of books. I was just curious for your thoughts on that. I suspect there are ways in which that's an advantage and ways in which it might be a disadvantage. And in terms of your process for writing and the reception you get, whether the fact that you're not particularly interested in the game itself comes into play.
Right. Look, everybody's taken by surprise when I say that I'm not a soccer fan. I think everybody sort of assumes, because I write about it frequently, that I must be really interested in the game, and I'm not. To be honest, I think it's more, it's an advantage in the sense that, you know, if you really look, what I'm writing about is, I'm not writing about football. I mean, I don't write about a match. I don't follow scores. It really is the political, the politics of it that fascinates me. But by and large, I think it's, I think it's a disadvantage. Because when it comes to knowing, I mean, I meet players, I meet referees, I meet coaches, but it's really only those that are the more political ones. And the conversation I have, the conversations I have with them are not about the sport itself. It's about the politics of it. And so as a result, you know, you asked me about a player, you asked me about a match, you asked me about a tactics strategy of a club or a national team. I have what the Dutch call a mouthful of teeth. With other words, I have no idea. And to be honest, that, I think, is a disadvantage in the sense that I probably, it would help to be able to have that conversation. Now, how much of a disadvantage is it? I don't think it's been a major disadvantage, but I think there would have been mileage in had I invested in more knowledge about the game.
That's a great answer, James. One very interesting to think about. No, it is. It is. It's interesting to think about. Any questions from people who have not participated yet? I know James had some invitees who are new to the forum.
David Kilpatrick has a question from Twitter. Could ask that?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. David Kilpatrick says he's just wondering what the latest crackdown in Turkey has meant for football clubs and their ultras.
Well, I mean, look, first of all, there's a whole history here. Both Egypt and Turkey tried to criminalize the ultras. In both cases, court proceedings were initiated. In Egypt, they went somewhat further because at one point a court did declare the ultras to be a terrorist organization, although that ruling was subsequently overturned. In Egypt, the case against 35 members of Çarşı, the militant group that supports Beşiktaş in Istanbul, had to be dropped because the prosecution simply couldn't make the case. I think that what you're seeing now is that football players, football fans, fall into the vast, just sweeping crackdown on anybody and everybody who is considered to be critical of the regime. Two instances to point to is one is Hakan Şükrü, who was probably one of Turkey's foremost all-time players, who was elected to parliament several years ago as a member of President Erdogan's party, then declared his support for Fethullah Gülen, the self-exiled preacher who's being accused of having staged the July 15 failed coup attempt. He was forced to basically leave the country before he was arrested. The stadium earlier that was named in his name was renamed, of course, the Recep Tayyip Erdogan Stadium. And you see the same thing with the football club in Diyarbakir in southeastern Turkey, which is a predominantly Kurdish city, informally viewed as the capital of Turkish Kurdistan, if you wish, which I think it was 2 years ago, if I'm not incorrect, maybe a little less, dropped its identity as a Turkish club with a Turkish name, namely Diyarbakir, adopted a Kurdish name, and very much projected itself as a Kurdish club. That club is now obviously in deep trouble. What you have seen prior to the coup, and I think you will see over time again, was that you had clashes on the pitch between Turkish nationalists and Kurdish nationalists. And as this all escalates and moves forward, I think those clashes are probably going to be more accentuated.
Great. Let's bring in a question from Daniel. Daniel, you can go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, James. Very nice listening to your voice and analysis. I'm very good. From Beirut, Lebanon. I would like to hear your take on the recent Olympic Games. What were for you interesting topics? I have three things in mind. First of all, first gold medal for Jordan ever. It was somebody of Palestinian origin. Then the big topic, if it comes to Qatar and Bahrain, large teams, but a majority of them naturalized. Do they understand in Bahrain and Qatar how much negative press they get worldwide for these kind of teams with so many naturalized athletes who do not even speak Arabic? And finally, on like women issues, Iran won its first female medal ever after having won in the entire history of the Olympic Games only a male medal before. I think that's historic. But on the other hand, there are also other trends, like that Iraq, for example, had no woman in the team. So it's not clear the picture for me, access for promotion of female athletes. So, I brought in our different keywords. So what's your take on the Olympic Games from the MENA point of view?
Look, obviously, I think that what you've overall seen is a better performance of athletes from the Middle East and North Africa than you have seen in the past, and particularly in a sense, non-traditional sport. So, for the Turks and the Iranians, it was always wrestling. And what you've seen is a much greater expansion. The fact that Iraq didn't have women, the fact of the matter is Iraq is not one of those countries that's the most problematic with women's sports. Iraq's problems are much deeper, of course. And because of the depth of those problems, there is indeed a far greater conservatism in the country, or at least in parts of the country. I'm not sure that that is the reason why you didn't see Iraqi women, but I wouldn't at this point attribute too much importance to it. What I think is the single most important issue, and you put your finger on it, but for very different reasons than you mentioned, is the fact that particularly the Qatari delegation had, they had 37 athletes, 23 were non-Qataris. And I don't think, sure, everybody jumped on that. It was a big media event. But frankly, I think that's irrelevant. What really is relevant, and that's why I think this was a very good thing that they did that, is, and this builds on the fallout or the impact that the awarding of the 2022 World Cup to Qatar is already having. And that is, it has fueled the discussion about the future of Qatari society. Keep in mind, Qatar is, a country of 2.3 million, of which only 300,000 are Qataris, 2 million are not. It is a demographic deficit that is unsustainable. There's no way that over time they will be able to sustain this, not only for all the economic reasons, but also because, like in other smaller Gulf states, you have generations who have lived there of people who have been born there, raised there, their whole social environment is Qatari in the sense it's in Qatar, and they have no prospect of becoming citizens. And what this, what the World Cup did is spark a discussion, cautious, but nonetheless, both in Qatar and in the UAE, about the question of naturalization. In Qatar, that's gone. In the UAE, it's been more about trying to reward those who have been long in the country and contributed to the development of the country. In Qatar, it's gone much further. You have people on Twitter tweeting, well, if we're giving citizenship to athletes, why aren't we doing that to doctors, engineers, nurses, bankers who contributed to the development of the country too? In fact, you've had a Qatari gay who wrote a very controversial piece, I think last month, didn't identify himself publicly, he wrote it under a pen name, but nonetheless, in which for the first time, he publicly discussed the problems and the difficulties that gays have in Qatar. So now, these are all minority vote voices. They don't reflect a majority point of view. But nonetheless, raising that those issues as broken taboos, these were not issues that ever were publicly discussed. And people could get into trouble for publicly discussing them. So I actually think that in terms of impact, the fact, it's much more important to me that they were having this discussion in Qatar itself than you have, the international media essentially mocking the Qataris for putting up a bunch of borders. With regard to Iran, there was one other event also in Iran during the Olympic Games, and that was the protest in favor of Iranian women's rights. And in fact, I spent today in Antwerp and the day with Daria Safai, who is the Iranian woman activist who travels from international tournament to tournament and enters the stadium and unfolds a banner demanding women's access, free or unfettered access to stadia.
Great. Any questions from people who have not participated yet? If not, we can move on to a round of second questions. Okay, we'll turn it back over to Peter then.
Okay. As someone who operates in a similar kind of area studies mode quite a bit, I do it in African studies, and this book kind of falls into Middle Eastern studies fairly squarely. There's always the question of how does this material relate to big themes that other specialists in other regions tackle. And I was thinking of racism as being a very interesting one that comes up at several points in the book. You mentioned, for example, the Drogba case, the killing of Ebosse in Algeria, the bitter hatred of Beitar fans for Palestinians and Muslims in general, the discriminations against Azeris in Iran or Kurds in Turkey, and so on and so forth. So I'm wondering if I could get your take in a little more depth, perhaps, about how does soccer, as you've analyzed it in the Middle East and North Africa, change our view of racism in sports?
I don't know that it does, frankly. First of all, the issue of racism is not an issue in most of the Middle East and North Africa. That's not to say that you don't have widespread racist attitudes. You do. But you don't have any, a social and political environment in which racism and the expression of racist attitudes is widely viewed as unacceptable or beyond the pale. In fact, if you look at it, there's only one, maybe two, I'm not sure about Turkey. Turkey probably does, but certainly the only other National Football Association that at all has an anti-racism program is Israel. Most don't. In Algeria, the issue became an issue because of the death of a player, a black player. And it also became an issue against the backdrop of the fact that you have a large number of African migrants, some truly refugees, many of them economic migrants, who moved through Morocco. Keep in mind that Morocco still has two cities on its coast that are Spanish territory, not Moroccan territory. And therefore, Morocco is a gateway to Europe, a difficult one increasingly, but nonetheless a potential gateway to Europe. And so there's a lot of issues over migrants, much like you have in other countries. You've had one incident in Saudi Arabia where there were racist expressions on the pitch, and indeed the Saudi Football Federation stepped in. But by and large, racism is not an issue, and the there's not been any great deal of pressure either from the Confederation of African Football or from the Asian Football Confederation for national associations to make racism an issue in the way that, for example, UEFA has done that.
Okay, well, what about sort of more popular expressions of this? I mean, one of the incredible things about the murder of Ebosse, the Cameroonian striker in Algeria, was, you know, that this was allegedly done, if I remember correctly, this was done by supporters of his own club.
That's correct. But and the fact that he was killed made it an issue. Had he just been booed, it would not have been an issue, at least not a major public issue. That's what I'm trying to get at. You don't have, I mean, you know, you look at the United States or countries in the West, or even Israel for that matter, despite Beitar and everything. Racism is not something that is that is viewed as an acceptable form of expression. And there is a strong response to it in the media. There's response to it by politicians and others. You don't see any of that in the Arab world. So the fact that you express yourself racist against a player of a different color, a skin color, that's not what's going to move public opinion. That's what I'm trying to say. Those sort of creation of social sensitivities, if you wish, is far less developed in much of the Middle East than it is elsewhere. And so the Cameroonian player really became an issue, because once you have a dead player, you no longer can avoid dealing with it. But that hasn't had great consequence in Algeria in terms of attitudes or in terms of trying to change attitudes.
Well, I guess that's what I'm getting at. I mean, that suggests a very, very deep-seated problem. Not so much the response, which, as you noted in the Abosay case, was rather muted, but that it exists and it seems to be accepted. Are you saying that this is generally how it is elsewhere as well, and that the Middle East and North Africa are not different?
I agree with you that it's a serious problem, but then it's one of very many serious problems in an environment in which policy, by and large, is exclusive, not inclusive. So, with other words, you're not talking about regimes in that part of the world that are trying to include various sectors of their society. On the contrary, look at this, look at the way the Saudis are using sectarianism and fueling a Sunni-Shia divide. That's going to take at least a generation to turn around, even if the Iranians and the Saudis would settle their differences today, simply because it's politically convenient. So if you look at what is being said by more conservative, more militant Muslim scholars, as well as, for that matter, politicians and elites across the Middle East, Sunnis about Shiites, and to a lesser degree, Shiites about Sunnis, it's explicitly racist. So in that environment, I would not expect that racism becomes a major issue, and certainly not in an environment in a region that is in the kind of turmoil that it is now.
Okay, I have a follow-up comment, but I'm going to pass the ball to Alex for a moment, who's moderating.
Question from Osasu.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, we can hear you.
How are you?
I'm all right. Sorry, I've been dipping in and out of this conference because you know how a journalist's life is. Kind of difficult to be focused on one thing when you've got news things buzzing. I'd like to ask a question on Egyptian football. As James knows, I have been to Egypt a few times, and I do cover stuff there. The last time I was in Egypt was in late May, and I spent some time with the former coach of Egypt, Hassan Shahata, and you read my interview with him, where he complained that he felt that he had been disrespected and his achievements had been disrespected since the Arab Spring took place. I really want to know what your views are on that. And the second thing is I tried to watch a game between Petrojet and Ahly at the Petrojet Stadium in New Cairo. And even though I had accreditation to cover the game, the police refused to let us in. And I can tell you that the policemen looked like they were geared up for war. It was not a nice environment outside of the stadium. I also want to know, what do you think about the ban which has been on for 5 years and which has had such an economic and social impact on Egyptian football? How long do you think this is going to continue? Because it's not good for Egyptian football. It's not good for the fans. It's agitating the fans against the government. but it appears that the government is resolute not to relax the ban. Thanks.
You're welcome. With regard to the coach, his name now slips my mind.
Hassan Shehata.
Yes, exactly. He is one of Egypt's most successful coaches, without question. He led Egypt to 3, I believe, consecutive African Cup titles in 2008, 2009, 2010.
Sorry, James, if you don't just mind me interrupting, not only is he the most successful Egyptian coach, no coach in the history of African football has achieved what he has achieved. None.
Fair enough. I take that point without question. He also was a storied player. However, his role in the 2011 popular revolt was a difficult one. He, like the Hassan brothers,
Hassan Ibrahim and Hossam, yes.
Right, they were fervent supporters of Hosni Mubarak. And they led demonstrations against the demonstrators in Tahrir Square. They called for the cutting off of all food and medical supplies to the square in an effort to squash the protests. They figured subsequently prominently on all kinds of blacklists that went around. And as a result, in at least those circles that were supportive of the toppling of Mubarak, their names were tarnished. Now, that's become a bit better now because of, you know, a lot of Mubarak people have been rehabilitated under the government of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. So I understand that he would feel that way. Having said that, it's not totally without reason that he has his detractors. More fundamental is the question of the fact that for the overwhelming majority of the period between 24 January 2011 and today, Egyptian stadia have been closed. Now, they're closed primarily, but not exclusively, because the Interior Ministry is afraid of having them open. Coming back to the earlier question that someone asked me about FIFA's role, one of the criteria that FIFA puts up for a club to be allowed to play in a Premier League is ownership or access on some fundamental basis to its own stadium. The one club in the Egyptian Premier League which has a stadium has never been allowed to use it by the security forces. And the security forces basically fear, not without reason, that stadiums run the risk of being a venue for mass protest. And I think it speaks to the insecurity of the al-Sisi regime that the stadiums are still closed. Now, having said that, there's been a lot of negotiation in Egypt between the Egyptian Football Association, the clubs, and the government on trying to, on ways to, and in fact, not, and even with the ultras themselves at times being involved in these negotiations, on trying to figure out a formula of how to open the stadia. And the formula that ultimately, in whatever variation, was developed was that the security inside the stadium would be taken over by private security companies, whereas the security of the perimeter of the stadium would be the prerogative of the security forces themselves. That has never been implemented for two reasons. One, because the Interior Ministry, which controls the security forces, has every time backed away from it because it feels that the situation hasn't stabilized to a point in which they can feel secure that there will not be a political fallout to this, even though the ultras actually have gone out of their way to demonstrate a degree of responsibility by curbing all kinds of things at the attendance of either international matches, which largely, even though very controlled, have been to some degree exempted from the ban, as well as attendance of club trainings. There's been an effort to by Sisi, the president himself, to try and reach out to the ultras, and in that way start a process that would lead to a reopening of the stadia to the public. That process didn't go anywhere, not because Sisi didn't want it to go anywhere, and not because the ultras didn't want it to go anywhere, but Sisi made an offer to the Al Ahly fans to investigate, to appoint investigators from among themselves to get to the bottom of what had happened on the 1st of February 2012, when 72 Ahly fans were killed in Port Said in what was the worst sporting incident in Egyptian sporting history, and to which the Al Ahly fans responded that they would not do that because they could not be both the judge and the accuser at the same time. So what you, in effect, have is a situation where all parties are grappling for a solution. The security forces don't feel secure enough to at least give some degree of to loosen their rein a little bit and turn over responsibility, at least to some degree, to a third party. There are also questions about the third party, the private security companies, given the fact that most of those private security companies are run by retired military personnel, senior military officers, and there's not a great deal of confidence in them.
Great. Any other questions? I think we have a few people on the call still who have not piped in. Maybe Alon or...
It's impossible that Alon doesn't have a question.
this is true. I'm going to unmute him just in case. Alon, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Okay, first of all, good morning. I'm sorry I joined the conversation late, so I don't want to repeat things that have been said. But first of all, thank you again, James, for a wonderful book and all the wonderful posts that you've put out there, and I've learned so much from. I don't really, there's so many... I think I'll just ask two quick questions. One is curious about the Syrian footballers that were pretty active in opposition to the Assad regime, a few years ago, and haven't read much about some players since. And then I'll ask a big question, and I don't know if your crystal ball is clear today or foggy, but... at the end of your book, at the end of your book, you talk a little bit. You mentioned that the Middle East could expect a decade or more of often messy and at times ugly and bloody political transition. I have to admit that after the events of when the Arab Spring erupted. I was very hopeful, just as I was hopeful after the Soviet Union collapsed, just as I was hopeful when Occupy Movement was active in the U.S. So if you don't mind taking out your crystal ball, what do you see for the Middle East? And I'm not going to hold you responsible for any predictions that are completely wrong. So...
Well, I'm happy to answer that. It's a question that goes far beyond football, of course. Let me talk briefly about Syria. And let me put it in a bit of a larger context, if you wish. It's quite remarkable. The Sicilians, in terms of performance, here's me who doesn't follow the game saying this, have actually performed very well. What you've seen is, I mean, the Syrians do still field a national team. You've had a number of players, including, and again, today's not my name, my day for names, but including a prominent youth player, a goalkeeper, and I think that's who you were referring to, in Homs, who was a leader of the popular revolt in Homs. He also is a folk singer and very well known for his singing. And he was seriously targeted by the regime of Bashar al-Assad. His family home was targeted. At least one of the 13 people were killed. At least one of his brothers. He's been wounded several times. And as the conflict progressed, he's also radicalized. And he ultimately became a member of the Islamic State, but several months ago left the Islamic State to join what was then Nusra. The group that was until recently affiliated with Al Qaeda. I think the larger picture is that you have a number of footballers who have joined the resistance. You have a number of footballers that have gone into exile. The Free Syrian Army has launched its own football team, very much in sort of the mode of the team that the FLN, the Liberation Front in Algeria, launched in the 1950s, and that helped put the Algerian national liberation struggle on the international map. Obviously, the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, doesn't have the kind of resources to really build it up. And then you have a few players, or at least one, who is a dual national, was outside of the country when the civil war erupted, did play for the national team, but got so disgusted with it that he decided to no longer play for them, even though he plays for a European team that is controlled by the Syrian Secret Service. And then you have the national team, which in my mind is put together by all legitimate and good players, but some are true believers, supporters of Bashar al-Assad. And keep in mind that Bashar al-Assad does have a popular base. He's not an isolated dictator. And including the coach, as well as the goalkeeper, for example, of the Syrian national team. They are truly supporters of the regime. And then you have a number of players who are there because they feel they have no choice. They either had no opportunity to leave the country, they opted not to leave the country because they see what's happening with refugees who do leave the country and do not find it very easy, or they have family members who don't want to leave or cannot leave, and therefore they don't want to risk retaliation against the family. So it's a very complex picture. Now, on the broader question, I would maintain what I said in the book, but I also want to bring Tess into this conversation, who's on the line. She and I just published a book 2 weeks ago in which we looked at, made a very first stab, and we're doing a second book on it, trying to answer the question of why Southeast Asia, the Philippines, despite Duterte, Indonesia, Myanmar, were relatively successful in a political transition, and the Middle East is what it is. And there were a bunch of reasons. There's the military, there's the role of civil society and the character of civil society. There's the way Southeast Asia managed ethnic conflicts and religious minorities. And of course, Southeast Asia does not have a Saudi Arabia. You said you were optimistic. You're not optimistic. I actually, despite the horrendousness of what's happening in countries like Syria, or the brutality of an Islamic State, or the brutality of the Sisi regime in Egypt, I am optimistic. I think we are at the beginning of a process of change, rather than at the end of it. Granted, one that is not a pretty picture and is not going to be a pretty picture for many years to come. And even if you do get a transition to something that's more open, more inclusive, it's going to take far more than 10 years to wipe out the effects of what's happening today. But it's a process that has started with a far greater deal of resistance and a far more vicious resistance than we've maybe seen in other parts of the world. But I think it is a process that's inevitable. And that's why through all the smoke and fire and blood, I'm still optimistic.
Okay, I think we've...
Not that that answers your question, but...
That's a good note to perhaps wrap this up, everyone, unless there are some final questions to ask in stoppage time. Anyone?
Yeah. I don't know if Tess wants to add something to this.
Yeah, feel free, because we're at 90 minutes.
Maybe I'll pass. It's been a very long and rich and complex session, but I do take note of the differences between Southeast Asia and the Middle East, and that's a study that we're continuing to undertake, both James and I. And it may be worth another session when the next book comes out.
Great.
Okay, excellent. Well, one announcement before we end, and that is that our next session is now officially scheduled for the 27th of October at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so minus 5 GMT, and it will feature a paper by Tarminder Kaur from the University of the Free State in South Africa on the Xhosa Maradona. So very interesting piece, and I hope you all can join us then on the 27th of October.
Let me just thank Peter and Alex for putting this together and for everybody for participating and really posing, I thought, challenging and interesting questions.
No, and thank you for your time and, of course, for the book. And I'm glad we met beforehand before meeting again in the virtual space. So it's good to hear you again after meeting up in Ofstra.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you all.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.